I'm going to talk about one of the issues that I find most interesting is the interaction between the protection of individual privacy and the protection of population safety. And that's the topic of this talk today. Let me see. And I'll briefly start out by showing you the whole continuum of public health surveillance and how privacy interacts with that continuum. Look at some of the federal and state law, which is kind of what I do for HIMSS, as Sterling mentioned. And then I'm going to talk about and show you a risk model that I developed actually about a year and a half ago, and I updated it for this presentation. And then we'll close with some recommendations and a summary. From the outset, I want to make it clear, I know a lot of people define the terms privacy and security differently, so as I speak today, these are the definitions that I'm using. Privacy is the state of being free from interference, free from, and the right in the United States, the right to be, you know, free to be left alone. In the privacy and security legislation that's coming down the pike, the bills that we see, more and more they tend to define privacy in terms of control, who has control over your health information. And then security is something that protects you. So in order to have privacy, you might have security will protect the confidentiality of health information, but it also protects the integrity of information as well as the availability of critical services. This is the public health timeline, and you can see across the bottom, situational awareness really spans from the exposure clear through to treatment and the countermeasures and case investigations all the way through. And if you look at this, if you look at privacy and data identifiability, the data become more and more identifiable along this timeline as we move from left to right along the timeline. And at the end, you know, when you're doing a case investigation or you're doing countermeasures at the end, then the data are electronic medical records. They are identifiable. So as the data become more and more identifiable, the privacy risk also goes up. The legal foundation for privacy protection in the U.S. starts with the U.S. Constitution, which gives us freedom of privacy. And then the Privacy Act of 1974 protected privacy for information used by the federal government. And then the Public Health and Welfare Act specifically defines privacy protection in the realm of public health. And it prohibits the disclosure of the identities of individuals and enterprises as well. Restricts the use of health information to the purposes for which it was collected. And it has specific provisions for the National Center for Health Statistics. And then it also has special provisions for certain classes of information. This is kind of a theme that you'll see running through legislation, and it creates challenges as well. The Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, contains both a privacy rule and a security rule. And the privacy explicitly says that health information can be shared for public health without the explicit consent of the individual. But it also requires that the information that's shared be restricted to the minimum necessary, and it requires auditing of the disclosure of the health information. But it's not really as straightforward as it seems to be for a couple of reasons. Number one, the HIPAA privacy rule talks about both providers and payers, and providers and public health, and in some cases public health are providers when they're providing health services. And secondly, the HIPAA privacy rule is superseded by any state law that is more strict than the privacy rule, and this creates complications as well. Another area that of complications is that there's variation there's variation on law both at the federal level and between the federal level and the state level. Every state has, and the federal government as well, have special protections for special types of health information, like alcohol and drug abuse information, like HIV AIDS, like abortion, like sexually transmitted diseases. There are these special types of information that require special protections, but those special protections are different from state to state. There are also differences in terminology between among the states, as well as between the federal government and the state governments. There are no standard consent forms. There's no standard consent requirement across the United States. And a lot of the laws that exist today were developed for paper-based electronic medical records, and they may not be applicable when in an electronic kind of a world. There are also inconsistent laws regarding the disclosure and the redisclosure of health information. And this is one of the problems with the HIPAA privacy rule right now that's a lot of the laws that are coming forward are trying to address, is that it doesn't really address the secondary distribution of health information. It talks about consent to share information to begin with, but once you've shared it, there's nothing that says they can't share it with others. Or business associate. There's nothing that says business associates can't share information. And finally, the point is that this inconsistency in state laws creates huge barriers to these health information exchanges that we're trying to build throughout the country, and they also create barriers for public health. So the real challenge is how can public health achieve and maintain that optimal balance between assuring the health and safety of the U.S. population and at the same time protecting the privacy of individuals within that same population. This is the risk model that I mentioned. It's an update to an earlier risk model. And you can see the actors in here, governments and risk and personal and private and healthy people. What we have is that governments have two values that often are in conflict. One is that they value personal privacy, and they also value the health of the population. And they're also out there, they're threat agents or biological hazards that create risk to personal privacy and risks to healthy people. So governments, in order to protect this value that they have, they enact public health laws and regulations, and they also enact privacy law and regulations to protect personal privacy and to protect healthy people. The public health law and regulations often require public health surveillance in order to reduce the risk to healthy people. And interestingly, both public health law and regulations and privacy law and regulations include security measures to reduce the risk to individual privacy. But this interaction between the two, between the law that protects personal privacy and the law that protects population health, creates some unintended consequences, as is often the case with law. Because if public health surveillance includes vulnerabilities, it creates risk to personal privacy. And let me give you a couple of examples of this. Our first example here is an online form, and this is to facilitate reporting of HIV/AIDS cases. And they create this website where people can go in and they enter their name and their password and they enter the information about the HIV case. But in this particular case, the bad guy sees this website, sees a chance to exploit personal health information, and so they undertake a phishing attack. So they create a website that looks exactly like the real website, but only it isn't the real website. And it looks like it's created, it asks for the name and it asks for the password. The person enters the name and enters the password, but you know, the bad guy doesn't care whether your password is right or not. He says, yeah, that's your password, all right, go ahead and enter your information, and captures the private information. The second example here is here a state implements a syndromic surveillance system that uses emergency room data that are sent from the hospitals across the state. And it replaces the individual identifier with a link, so that if a disease outbreak is detected, they can go back and retrace and find the patients so that they can be treated. But unfortunately, they use an algorithm that is disclosed, and so anybody who sees the case reports can then track it back to the individual. So these are both examples of how vulnerabilities in public health surveillance can create risks to individual privacy. The second unintended consequence is that you can have security measures and privacy law and regulations that impede public health surveillance, creating risk to healthy people. And these examples are, in one case, we have a state health department, again, develops a public health electronics system that detects this cluster salmonella along a state border. But unfortunately, because of the privacy law, the law prohibits the redisclosure of health information for treatment purposes, as many state laws do. And further, some of the patients reside in the neighboring state, and their state law doesn't allow sharing of information across the state line. So you have an example of where privacy law is creating risks to the population safety. And in the second, we have a local public health department that attempts to send a case report to the state health department, but as they're attempting to send this across, they're unable to authenticate themselves because the digital certificate has expired. It comes up and goes, your digital certificate has expired, you can't send this report. So again, you know, a problem in public health is creating the a problem in security is interfering with public health. Okay, here are some privacy policy recommendations. First is, historically, people dealing with security have adhered to the least privilege principle. And what the least privilege principle says, that each individual should have access to and only those privileges that they need to get their job done, and no more. Shouldn't have any more access than they absolutely need. Shouldn't have more privileges than they absolutely need. And the same thing certainly applies to public health. Only those identifiable elements that we absolutely need should be included. And each, the role and accesses and privileges given to an individual user should be only those that they absolutely need to get the job done. Secondly, is that we should restrict the use of individually identifiable health information to only those purposes for which it is intended. This is the public health law. It's consistent with the federal privacy law, and it's consistent with HIPAA as well. And also, when we implement system, just like the HIPAA security. Security rule specifies that you always need to be able to break the glass when necessary, and that applies to public health as well. When absolutely necessary, we need to be able to get to the information that's required. And then audit accesses to health and identifiable health information, remove it from systems when it's no longer needed to reduce that risk. And then the final thing is kind of my political plug here, is to support legislation and initiatives to unify the health privacy law across the country, because this does create problems, not only in public health, but in health care as well. Okay, the privacy rule identifies 18 elements, that if you remove those data elements, the information is no longer considered identifiable, or in the HIPAA language, protected health information, it can then be released to the public. And it is termed de-identifier, de-identified. What I wanted to show you is three examples where identifiable elements have either been removed or not removed. And we're going to look at the electronic lab reporting system, the NED system, and BioSense, the data that BioSense sends to hospitals. So we have one that's an interchange between a lab and a state, A second is from the state to CDC, and the third is from hospitals to CDC. And in each of these, I want to show you how they compare with HIPAA de-identification. Okay, in this first one, you'll see on the left-hand side, these are some of the elements that HIPAA requires to be removed in order for data to be considered de-identified. So on this slide, we have names, we have geographic subdivision, we have dates, and in the three columns, we have the electronic lab reporting system, NEDS, and BioSense. And you can see here that in the case of labs, the names and the contact information are still there because they're needed for lab-confirmed cases of reportable diseases so that they can go back to the local health department and say, look, we've confirmed this case of whatever it is. Secondly, in the geographic area, I think this is interesting as well, is that there are a lot more elements that are needed by public health than are needed in healthcare, or and so a number of these elements are required for the geographic information systems and to really see, to be able to visualize an outbreak or to figure out where services might be available to respond. And then finally is that the knowledge of the admit date, the discharge date, and the age are important to the development of the epidemiological profile. So you'll see more disclosures allowed there than would be allowed under HIPAA for de-identified as well. Okay, the second one are numbers, various numbers all the way down the left side, and then the final one is biometric identifiers. And here I thought two things are interesting in particular. Is one is the labs contact information for next of kin, contact information for the patients are needed for follow-up for lab-confirmed cases, so they are provided by the ELR system to the state. And then secondly is in these linkages out here on BioSense. And those are, they help ensure the integrity of the patient records, so that, because, you know, they're received in a number of messages that come across to BioSense, and these linkages are enable BioSense to link them all and know that they're a single individual. And then finally, these are photographic images and other unique, none of them use photographic images, but the other unique identifiers you'll see, these are there again to allow them to protect the integrity of case reports and allow them to construct the case reports. Okay. These are my security technology recommendations. We went through the policy recommendations. So technology recommendations, the first is, you know, use the HIPAA security rule, the administrative procedures and physical safeguards and technical security services. They're the same ones. They're equally applicable to public health as they are to healthcare, and they really are not that strict. You know, they're pretty much standard security measures that are used by any business that cares about security. And secondly is to use strong authentication, which is two-factor authentication, not just a password, but a password and an X509 certificate, or a password and a biometric. Mutually authenticate the endpoints. This is what will keep you from falling victim to the phishing scandal, because if you mutually authenticate, you not only authenticate the individual, but you also authenticate the website at the other end so that you know that this is the public health department. It's not the bad guy trying to capture my information. Encrypt information both at rest and as it moves and in transmission. And then finally, I think this is really important, although it's not a HIPAA requirement, it should have been. Is that you implement solutions that impose minimal disruption and delay in the workflow. Because whenever you implement security measures that make the user's job harder, they're going to do everything in their power to circumvent the security measures. So it's really important that as you implement security, you implement it such that it's easier to do the right thing than the wrong thing. I think the Finn messaging system is a great example of a system that CDC's built that follows every one of these. You know, it does every one of these. It implements the security measures required by the HIPAA security rule. It uses strong authentication, X509 certificates, to authenticate both sides. To mutually authenticate both the users and the endpoint, sender and the receiver. It encrypts data for transmission, and it's very simple solution, which is why it's had very wide adoption as well. And then the final thing is that one of the things that I talked to the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics about 2 years ago about, and now they're just starting to pay attention to it, is the use of information rights management or digital rights management to protect the secondary use of information. And DRM or IRM is technology that goes with the data. So when you store the data in the database, the data contain the rights that says you can, for example, you can have a policy that says the person can read this, but they can't save it. You know, that's a nice policy for claims attachments that's sent to the payer to show that they actually should reimburse, but then they don't have to keep it forever. So the use of IRM is, I think we'll see it used more and more in healthcare, and it's a good technology for exactly that, you know, control the flow of health data. Okay. In summary, detecting biological events as near to the time of the initial exposure, of course, we all know is very important. And it does have the potential to significantly reduce the risk to the population. And HIPAA does explicitly say that public health can use private information without the consent of the patient. But it also, we may have to make sure that the data that we asked for is the minimum necessary. And then finally, achieving and maintaining the optimal balance between individual privacy and population health is a continuous challenge for public health, but I think it's certainly one that is well worth the effort. Okay. Yes. Yeah, it's a technology, and it can be implemented in software or hardware. It's usually implemented in a combination of both. Originally, it's digital rights management, and so it's the same technology that's used to keep somebody from copying a movie that you download from the internet, or restricting how many systems that you can put a music on, right? It came from there. And in fact, one of the reasons why they started using the term information rights management when applied to content other than entertainment media is because of all the negative press it's gotten from the entertainment business, but it's exactly the same technology. And Intertrust has had most of the patents to this technology, and all of those patents were bought by Microsoft. So Microsoft, Oracle, and Adobe probably have the three main software products that do information rights management. But if you're familiar with Documentum, I'll give you that as an example. But basically, it has you wrap the information in the usage rules that you want to apply. You can say, okay, you can view this, but you can't print it, for example, right? Or you might say, you can view this, but you can't save it to disk. Or you can save it to disk, but you can't modify it. You know, you can apply to particular data, and I use information, and I use that very loosely because it can be a data element. It could be a whole a file. You know, but it's a data, it's an information object that you apply the rules to. And then it also incorporates who can receive it. whether it be roles or individuals, usual rights, access management kind of thing. And then when the receiving system receives it, they also have the IRM technology, and they will go to a trusted third party, interpret the rules that are in that wrapped, in the wrapper around that content, and then the local software will enforce the rules. Software or hardware, it's implemented both ways. So if you go to the Documentum go to a Documentum and look up their content management, and it's bundled with that. The Microsoft product is called Rights Management System, RMS. And it's fairly new. It was invented maybe 10 years ago, but it's just now really catching on.